Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Right Time. My name is Bomani Jones. Thanks for listening. Wherever you get your podcasts, rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. Coming up on this episode of The Right Time, I'm going to talk about the weekend in college football, one of the strangest things I've ever seen, the troll god at the U.S. Open, and the time you invented something like LeBron kind of sort of halfway not really says he invented Taco Tuesday. But first, hey, man, shout out to everybody that ever swore they could do their jobs better than their bosses can and then messed around and got the job that their bosses had. And everybody's looking at you being like, yo, you have no idea how to do your job, because that is Bill O'Brien with the Houston Texans, who like, hey, man, I want to have charge of personnel. I want to be the one that makes the general managing type of decisions. And so they got the general manager up out the paint. They went and tried to hire this dude from the Patriots, but it looked like they tampered, so they had to get him out the paint. And they said that they were then going to run things by a committee. But we all know a committee can't run things. Somebody got to be in charge. And by most accounts, it appears that Bill O'Brien is the guy who is now in charge of the Houston Texans. And let us take a brief moment to appreciate the insanity of this. They decided to trade Jadeveon Clowney at a point at which he could not sign a long-term deal with them or anybody else. In fact, at a point where you couldn't trade Clowney anywhere he did not want to go, because in order to trade him, he had to sign the franchise tender, which he had not done yet. Therefore, he got to dictate where he went, and you just had to go for scraps on whatever it is that you might have been able to get back, because you were so intent on trading a dude that can make your football team better right now. So you go ahead and you trade Clowney, you get a third round pick, you get Kiki Mingo, who was a bust, and then some other linebacker. Backer dude that Seattle was thinking about releasing anyway. All right. Once that happens, everybody's out here in these streets and they're like, yo, man, y'all need an offensive line. How come you didn't get offensive lineman in this trade? How could you go out here and not get an offensive lineman? He's like, damn, yo, man, I guess you're right. I need to go get an offensive lineman. And so they went and got Laremy Tunsil from the Dolphins, which is cool. Except they gave up all the picks in the world in order to do it. So they got Tunsil and they got Kenny Stills. Shout out to Stephen Ross, getting that little bit of a problem out of there. Got him gone. What'd they give up? 2 first-round picks and some later picks?
Yeah, that's it.
Yo! And so now, like, good for the Dolphins. You got a million different picks. Good for the Texans. You now have Laremy Tunsil. I just need you to reconcile this for me, ladies and gentlemen of America. Trading for Tunsil is a win-now move. There's no way around that. You don't make a trade and give up all that capital unless it is a win now situation. You know what would really help you win right now? Jadeveon Clowney. He would really, really, really help you win right now. Like, am I the only person that sees it that way? I feel like he could help you win right now. And by the way, while J.J. Watt came back from those injuries being a monster, I don't know how long you're going to keep betting on him in year 9 after back surgeries and everything else. You got a 26-year-old dude who is actually better than the numbers seem to indicate that he is. And O'Brien got him out of there, as far as I can tell, just because he doesn't like him very much. Like, that's the only way this makes any sense. I've been watching football long enough to know that when these franchise tag situations come up like this, what you say as a team is, if you want to make money, this is the place where you're going to have to come in order to make money. You don't want to come to training camp? Fine, don't sign the tender. You'll get in here whenever you can, because we can't sign you to a long-term deal anyway. Nobody can sign you to a long-term deal. So why don't you come on in? And somehow the Texans were like, nope, nope, nope. We'd rather get 2 mediocre players and the third-round pick that we'd get anyway when you walked. What? And then you go give up so much of the future in order to get the left tackle that you need? Dog, y'all better win a Super Bowl right now. Right now. And see, I understand part of this also is that O'Brien, I think, is at the place where if they don't win a playoff game this year, O'Brien won't be the coach no more. Like, as simple as that. He's had his time. If they don't win a playoff game, he's not going to be the coach anymore. So he's making the kind of move that you need to do right now. This is part of why you don't put your coach in charge of personnel unless he has all the job security in the world, because he's going to wind up making win now moves when you need to have a broader perspective, right? Some moves need to be win now. Some moves need to be about the future, but there's got to be a relative level of balance on this. And with O'Brien, O'Brien just looked like he told somebody, do whatever it takes to get me back a left tackle. And so they went and got Tunsil. And by the way, good on you for finally going around and getting you that left tackle. And I say that because Deshaun Watson, do not forget that last year, Deshaun Watson was so hurt because he had them busted up ribs. That dude had a stretch of the year where he couldn't get on planes because he couldn't handle the air pressure. So they put that dude on a bus to ride from Houston to Jacksonville. On a bus. Halfway across the country on I-10 because that dude couldn't get on a plane. This was all shaping up for Deshaun Watson to retire in 2024, much the way that Andrew Luck decided that he was going to get up out the paint. Like, that's exactly what that was looking like. And so here we are with the Houston Texans. Gabe, did it make any sense to you?
It made no sense. It made sense to Seahawks fans. That's who it made sense to.
Oh, dude, that's a win for them. Like, I'm not exactly sure how they're going to use Clowney there, but they will find a way. They will figure it out. And that is a giant win for Seattle. Like, I looked up at that and was just like, oh, y'all aren't even playing fair. By the way, you know who else plays for Seattle? Dwayne Brown, who was a franchise-level offensive tackle for the Houston Texans, but he wanted out of there in a large part because he didn't want to play for Bob McNair no more. Now, Bob McNair does not own the Texans anymore, as you may know. R.I.P. His son apparently has some slightly different sensibilities, which you must assume by the fact that they went and acquired Kenny Stills. But they could have still had Dwayne Brown when you stop and think about it. Because, guys, having a left tackle in this league really matters. It really, really matters, especially if you care anything about the health of your quarterback. It's helpful to have. But, nope, then there's Bill O'Brien. And I'll tell you something I learned a long time ago, man. There is a good chance that your boss may have been getting on your nerves, but there's something about your boss's job that you yourself do not understand. And that job is not necessarily as easy as it looks. Like, Gabe, did you watch The Wire by chance?
Oh, you know it.
Okay, so you remember when Jimmy got to run his own detail? You remember how that went for Jimmy?
Not great.
That sounds a lot like Bill O'Brien, doesn't it? Also, think about this with O'Brien. O'Brien hasn't done anything to demonstrate that he should be the guy that has that level of control. Now, I want to make something clear, because if you've been listening to me over the years, you know I'm not that wild about O'Brien. But I had to give him some credit since they got Deshaun Watson in that he adapted what he wanted to do around the quarterback that he had. Watson is not the type of quarterback that O'Brien typically wants. He did adapt his style around the quarterback that he had, which is something that not every NFL coach is going to do. You can make the argument he was doing it just to save his job, but again, a lot of cats would rather get fired than start adjusting. He did the things that he had to do on that front, but now the reason you don't put your coach in charge is your coach does dumb things like saying Jadeveon Clowney needs to get out of here because maybe, just maybe, he loafs every now and then. Yeah, he does. He also wreaks havoc. He wreaks havoc. There are three positions in the NFL that, as long as I can remember, have been considered to be at an absolute premium. Quarterback, left tackle, and pass rusher. They've got the quarterback. They now have the left tackles that gave up the world to get them. Yeah, they had J.J. Watt. They have J.J. Watt. Good to have a pass rusher. But the one thing that you can't have too many of is pass rushers. Like, anybody whose outlook is, I'll draft every pass rusher I can get, I understand that. I remember the Giants used to have that outlook, and people looked at Jerry Reese crazy for that, and they won two Super Bowls largely because of it, because you can never have too many pass rushers. What's monstrous about Clowney and Watt, though, is these dudes aren't just pass rushers, right? Like, you can move both of them inside and have them shut down the run if that's what it comes down to. Hell, they had Clowney playing middle linebacker at points in the last couple of seasons, right? He had the knee injury early. The dude hadn't really missed many games the last 2 or 3 years. Like, these aren't the issues. It all just stacks up to O'Brien don't really rock with him like that. And that's dumb. That's dumb, that's dumb, that's dumb, that's dumb, that's dumb. And now the pressure that's going to be on him and the pressure that's going to be on everybody else is sky, sky high. All because you let your coach run the front office. I can't find anybody around the Texans in Houston anywhere. I can't find anybody that's like, look at the bright side of this trade. Like, the Tunsil trade becomes weird. And one that in some ways I could halfway defend, except I just feel like there's no way they needed to give up everything that they gave up in order. I think there had to be a better way. But at once, I do believe that teams overvalue draft picks. I really think that fans overvalue draft picks. And the reason that fans overvalue draft picks is that they love to play along with the draft. And so everybody has bought into the idea that you build through the draft. You do. And I do buy into the idea, like for the Dolphins, for example, you have all those picks now. I guess that's cool, but what they are is lottery tickets. It's just more chances for you to cross your fingers and hope that you get everything right. So like the Dolphins, they traded away Laremy Tunsil to get picks. And you know what they hope they might be able to get out of one of those picks? A guy as good as Laremy Tunsil. Like, you traded away your left tackle. It wasn't because they had some surplus at tackle. They traded away their left tackle, and they're going to be back in the draft hoping that they can get a left tackle. Now, I've seen people say with the Dolphins, well, yeah, man, but they're just trying to get a quarterback. You know what would really be helpful to have with that quarterback? A left tackle. You know what you're going to get right after you get that quarterback? A left tackle. You know what you're going to be doing? Hoping that that left tackle is as good as Laremy Tunsil, who right now is not great, but is young and very good. You're going to be hoping that you get a left tackle as good as Laremy Tunsil. That doesn't really make any sense to me, right, on that level. But again, I see that people overvalue draft picks, except when you really need draft picks is when you have a quarterback who's getting paid $30 million a year. Guess what, guys? We're right around the corner from the time where the Texans quarterback is going to be paid $30 million a year. It's about time for Deshaun Watson raise, right? He's going to be in year four next year. I figure they'll pick up the option on year five for him, but they're going to need to start figuring out how it is that they are going to pay him. You know who else the Texans have to figure out how they're going to pay? Laremy Tunsil, the dude who has all the leverage in the world. Why does he have all the leverage in the world? Because you fools traded away two first-round picks and more in order to get him. What you going to do after you do that? You going to get him, then keep him for 2 years, and then let him walk? Right? You going to try some kind of franchise tag mechanism when it comes to him? Like, what are you going to do? You have to pay that dude now. So now you're going to have to pay big money for that left tackle because you have to pay big money for him because you need to protect the quarterback that you're going to be paying big money for. Like, all of this is like, wow, you know, I hadn't thought of that. Like, I feel like in the end, after O'Brien made those trades, I feel like somebody walked up to him and was like, hey, let me run this by you. And he was like, wow, you know, I hadn't thought of that. Maybe just maybe because he was a little bit too busy coaching the football team. Hey, I understand. You're too busy coaching the football team to actually run the football team. That makes perfect sense. That's why you shouldn't be the dude running the football team. Right? Just that simple. That's why you shouldn't be the dude that's running the football team. But here we are. Here they are. That's what it is. It is going to be weird if the Texans start off like 6-1 and 6-2. With the Clowney trade, I think it's a bad idea for them to get rid of him, but I think they can still, like, you know, put together a good defense without him, but I think it's a bad idea to get rid of him. So I think we're going to see his departure. But since they traded for Tunsil and they didn't have to give away any actual players, they just got back two dudes who they're going to be able to plug in, the offense should be better. And when the offense is better at the beginning of the year, of course we're going to have people coming up every Sunday when they win. Oh, you guys thought that Tunsil trade was a bad idea. Yeah, but I don't think any of us thought that Tunsil wasn't a good player. Right? Like, the argument is not that Tunsil isn't a good player. The argument is that it's a bad trade for the long run, and this is only sufficient in the short run if they win it all. Like, that's the only way you're going to convince me that this is the groove, is if you win it all. And I don't think they're going to win it all. Let me tell you something wild about this 2014 draft while I'm thinking about it, because Clowney, I think a lot of people have in their minds that Clowney is a bit of a bust, or they've had those thoughts in their minds, and I don't blame them necessarily for having those thoughts in their mind. But, dude, listen to all the players who went in the top, like, 32, 34 picks of that 2014 draft. Clowney, Khalil Mack, Jake Matthews, Mike Evans, Anthony Barr, Taylor Lewan, Odell Beckham, Aaron Donald, Kyle Fuller, Ryan Shazier, Zach Martin, C.J. Mosley, D. Ford, this is the other one I'm looking for, DeMarcus Lawrence, Derek Carr. Derek Carr went at 36. Yo, man, this is a quietly loaded draft. Not quite the 2011 draft, which just has Hall of Famers all over the place, but it is possible that Clowney is like the fifth best player in this draft, and he has actually come around to being about as good as we thought that he should have been. But I think it could be easy to lose sight of how good he is based upon what he is relative to those other dudes who were in the draft. But nah, man, he's a monster, and that's bad news for everybody in the NFC West. All right, we'll be back in a minute to talk about the weekend in college football. But first, It's a fact refinancing your credit card balances can lower your interest rate and save you money. And you don't have to be a financial expert to do it. Right now, you can get a credit card consolidation loan from my friends at LightStream with a rate as low as 5.95% APR with AutoPay. That's lower than the average credit card interest rate of over 19% APR. That means you can save thousands of dollars in interest. Get a loan from $5,000 to $100,000, and there are absolutely no fees, no application fees, no origination fees, no transaction fees, no prepayment penalties. You can even get your own money as soon as the day you apply. The application is so easy, you can apply right from your phone. LightStream believes that people with good credit deserve a better loan experience, and that's exactly what they deliver. Just for my listeners, apply to get a special interest rate discount. The only way to get this discount is to go to lightstream.com/Bomani. LightStream.com/Bomani. Subject to credit approval, rate includes 0.50% auto pay discount. Terms and conditions apply and offers are subject to change without notice. Visit lightstream.com/Bomani for more information. All right, man. College football this weekend. I am from the South. So, you know, college football means something a little different to me. I am going through this year of, is Texas back?
Texas is back, folks!
To be fair, I wish it had happened every year. It's only been a legitimate question, truly, like, this year. It's been bad. The thing I have to say, though, about Texas, so this idea of, like, is Texas back, and this is something I just don't think that people understand. Do you know how many times in the last 45 years Texas has outright won a conference championship?
Can you count them on one hand?
7 times in 45 years have they won an outright conference championship. Let me put that in perspective for you, okay? Bob Stoops, in his time at Oklahoma, won the Big 12 10 times. 10 times. You see the point I'm making here? Texas, by the way, has won the Big 12 3 times total. Conference has been around for 23 years. They've won it 3 times. So, yeah, college football season's here. We got Texas. We got LSU this weekend. I'm going to figure out how to manage my emotions around that stuff. But, you know, that's what we got. Get ready. College football season is here. Jalen Hurts killing it the other night. People got all charged up about that. Ain't nothing better for your Q rating than having a really good game on a night where there's only one game. People like that. People like that. When there's only one game and you go out there and kill it, there you go, big homie. That's what Jalen Hurts did. I don't know how good he is. I saw those dudes were running down the field wide open, whatever. All right, good for Jalen Hurts. Auburn, I can tell, is going to have one of those bizarre, right, Auburn years where they'll luck their way into wins and luck their way out of wins and everything else. And Gus Malzahn going to be living on that hot seat. Gabe, your man Clay Helton, should he go ahead and put his house up for sale now after their little quarterback got hurt?
My man, Clay Helton. I mean, it's in my interest for Clay Helton to be in that job as long as possible, right?
Dude, Urban Meyer just down there working for Fox, scouting out his seat every day.
Getting ready.
Getting ready every day. We have that one. But what we also have is maybe the most bizarre thing I have ever seen around college football. And if you listen to the pod that we did with Spencer Hall last week, we all acknowledge that, like, bizarre things in college football are fairly common. So I won't say definitively that this is the most bizarre thing I've ever seen, but I feel like it's very high on the index and the margin of bizarreness. Okay. What was up with your man, Hugh Freeze, coaching from a hospital bed? They brought a hospital bed because he got a staph infection. They brought a hospital bed up to the press box, and that dude sat up there in his hospital bed letting people take pictures of him as he coached the football team from the press box. And I just don't understand how anybody is doing anything other than ridiculing this man for that shameful display of arrogant look-at-me behavior. Are you serious? Dog, go home. Go home. You know a big part of why I want you to go home under those circumstances? It's because the signal you are giving as coach when you're like, yeah, staph infection, oh well, wheel me out of my hospital bed and put me in the press box. Hey, what you think it's going to be like for them players and they try to be like, coach, I'm hurt, I can't play.
The excuse is not going to fly.
Yeah, no, man. I couldn't believe I sat up there and watched that man in that press box doing that. And I'm just like, first of all, I can't believe that this man still has a job. Because he got this his new job. But I guess I do kind of understand how it is that Hugh Freeze got this job. Like, you know where he coaches now, right?
Liberty.
Yeah, you're familiar with Liberty, right?
Semi-familiar only from the standpoint that I had a colleague that went to Liberty.
All right, so are you familiar with Liberty, like, outside the context of football, like what Liberty stands for in this nation?
No, I do not.
Okay, do you know who the founder of Liberty University is?
I do not.
Jerry Falwell.
Who is blank.
Yeah, go ahead and Google that right fast. So this is the Jerry Falwell School that is now run by Jerry Falwell Jr. And I don't know if you guys have been reading the news, but let's just say there is reason to believe that Jerry Falwell Jr. is not the guy who is allowed to pass judgment on Hugh Freeze just because he may or may not have called a couple hookers on work trips from the phone that the state gave him.
Now I'm catching up here. Quite the second chance for Hugh Freeze.
Yes. So there's a Hugh Freeze. Check Jerry Falwell Jr. And whenever you get all the information, it don't matter what I'm saying. Go ahead and pop up because I can't wait for all this to settle upon you at one time. But no, Jerry Falwell Jr. does not get to judge Hugh Freeze for his little hooker situation when he was at Ole Miss, right? Because I remember when Hugh Freeze got that job at Liberty, you know, because Hugh... The thing with Hugh Freeze, again, was it wasn't just that he got caught with the hookers, is that he wraps all his stuff up in that Jesus. And since he wraps all his stuff up in that Jesus, it gets to be a little awkward when you then get caught with the hookers. And then he goes to Liberty, and see, Liberty, the religious school, has always got an interesting position they can play in a situation like this. Because on one hand, the religious school could turn you away from picking up the hookers because they got values they want to represent. Or they can hit you with the everybody deserves forgiveness. That's what Jesus was about. And then they can let you come back, right? Like you can put yourself in any position that you need to be put in to do what you want to do under those circumstances. That's the place that they were. So they went and got Hugh Freeze because A, Hugh Freeze is probably a better coach than they would ever be able to get. And B, as Gabe will soon find out, all of this appears to be very, very on brand for Hugh Freeze and very on brand for Liberty, right? It is a perfect fit, assuming a fit can be perfect with all the circumstances that come together right here with them. Ooh. And this group. Oh, caught up!
Ooh, there is so much to unpack here.
Yes. So you're caught up on the elder and the younger.
Oh, yes.
Yes. So you see why I say that there's not room to judge.
Yes.
Now, let me tell you something that's interesting that's going on in total with Liberty. It's part of why I wanted to do this, because I think it's worth some intellectual rigor as we discuss this. All right. Before the older Falwell died, he said that what he wanted was for Liberty to be a top 25 football program. Like, that was a goal for Jerry Falwell, and I don't blame him for wanting to put a level of emphasis on it. And the reason I don't blame him for that is, look at BYU, right? I'm not saying that BYU and Liberty are the same school. I'm not saying that they're like there's similarities ideologically between the two of them. I'm honestly not informed enough to get into, like, the weeds of that kind of stuff. But what I can say is, BYU football is the most visible public representation of the Church of Jesus Christ and Latter-day Saints. You know, because the people in this country have their views on Mormons and what they believe and all of this, right? I don't like to get into how y'all, I'm not a religious person, and I don't like to get into how y'all feel about each other's religions, because I feel like everybody, when it comes to religion, has to kind of admit, when you start pointing at other people's religions and being like, whoa, that's weird, a finger's coming back. Right? Somebody's got something they can point to, no matter who you are, to be like, wait a minute, you saying that to me? That's just kind of the nature of how that stuff happens to go, right? But in terms of a public representation of the Church of Jesus Christ and Latter-day Saints that, like, is non-controversial, it's the football team. And it becomes a thing for them where if you have members of your church in all these places around the country, yo, BYU shows up in your town, there's a good chance you're going to be sold out. Because your city has a Church of Jesus Christ. Yo, Gabe, did you know that Harlem has a Church of Jesus Christ in Latter-day Saints?
I'm not surprised.
There's one. No, but it's been there like 15 years.
They're everywhere.
Yeah, but I mean, like on Lenox, it's a couple of blocks north of the intersection of Malcolm X Boulevard and Martin Luther King Drive. Couple blocks north, Mormons. Yeah, they out there. They've been in their short sleeve shirts trying to talk to you about stuff. Right there on Lenox. They're there. Anyway, my point being, wherever they show up, man, people gonna buy tickets to watch them play football, but it's a great way to, like, carry the brand of your message. Like, that's what it is. So I get where Falwell's like, yo, we want to be a top 25 program. And it was at this time where you start getting more, like, more schools moving into Division 1A. They're in a state in Virginia that produces a lot of really good football players, but there aren't always necessarily big-time colleges near those really good football players. So for the longest, that Tidewater area of Virginia that produced, you know, Allen Iverson, Michael Vick, like that whole round of guys, for the longest, the closest Division 1A school, I guess now FBS school to that area was East Carolina. East Carolina got Michael Vick on campus for a recruiting visit because it's the closest school. It's the closest. Like, that's where it's at. So, look, you're Liberty. You're like, yo, man, we can start a program. We can get us some players. And we can start getting our name out there in a way that isn't necessarily, like, attached to the political things that come when you start talking about Jerry Falwell and everything else. We can get this out here. But this is my question for you. And I ask this sincerely. If y'all don't ever want me or anybody else to talk about politics or whatever it is, how are we ever supposed to talk about Liberty? Like, are we just supposed to ignore it? Because if we ignore it, we are in effect talking about politics when it comes to Liberty. Because part of what I think they want you to do is to ignore it. So we just got to go along with it. Like, is that what the play is that we are making? Like, seriously, is that what we are going to do here? And I ask you to think about this, too. If there was any other college football program that was not, like, associated with any kind of church or anything like that, and I told you that their chancellor, president, whatever his official title is, was in the situation that he's in right now, and they hired the guy that was in the situation that Hugh Freeze was in right there, man, we'd be talking about that all the time. Right. So I'm asking you this, sincerely. For the people that don't believe we should ever talk about politics when we talk about our sports, what do you want us to do when somebody is consciously using sports as a Trojan horse for their politics? Because acting like it's not politics is politics. So what exactly are you supposed to do? In the meantime, what we're going to do is look up and be like, why is that fool in the press box in a hospital bed? I guess that's a start. All right, U.S. Open time. I made it out there on a Friday night. I saw Madison Keys play somebody she beat. And I saw Djokovic play somebody he beat. He beat a dude from the United States. His name was Kudla. That's what it was. I watched that. And he smoked that dude. My goodness. I felt bad for that. Like, Kudla wasn't even. It was one of those where you're watching it and you're like, I don't know how good Kudla is. All I know is that Djokovic is way better than him. But I'm like, he ain't even out here playing bad. He's just out here getting smoked. They're all almost all out to paint. Well, Serena's the only American woman left. So I'll say the rest of these are all out to paint. But we got the Coco story. We had Katie McNally, you know, she got smoked by Serena, but, well, she got beat. I think she didn't get smoked, but she got beat. We had the Katie McNally, we had the Taylor Townsend. I feel like I'm missing another young American lady. Or maybe I'm not. But either way, we had some interesting stories. Are you on the Coco train?
I have enjoyed watching her, certainly. I think it's like an inspirational story. You've got a teenager out there playing on a high level with the others. I'm a big fan of Osaka, though.
Yeah.
So I wasn't about to see her beat Osaka.
Osaka wasn't about to see her beat Osaka.
Man, she was here for it. She was ready.
Look, man, I know what it looked like when somebody left the house. It was like, I ain't losing this one. Uh-uh. No siree, Bob. Oh, no, 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 no. Osaka beat Coco so bad, I'm surprised somebody didn't try to call her one of the crabs in the barrel. She was like, no, you are not coming up over me. Under no circumstance whatsoever. And you could tell it from literally the first point. She was like, oh, no, 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 no. I'm about to beat the hell out of you. And she did. See, I like Coco. Coco, go hard. Like, that's the thing I rock with about her is she is going hard. She's putting everything in it. She's getting them points. She's doing the fist pumps and everything else. Covering the court like a monster. Did you see Cameron on Instagram doing tennis color commentary? You know what was so funny about that? That is the most positive Cameron has ever been about anybody in life. Cameron's persona for almost 25 years has just been 100%. Like, that's what he gives you. And that's especially what he gives you on Instagram. Nah, man, Coco and Osaka had Cameron, like, feeling a level of, like, positivity that has never come out of his soul. Never, ever, ever, ever come out of his soul. And also what I loved about that is, since most people don't really follow tennis that closely, I believe that everything he was saying is, like, descriptors of the competitors is basically the conversation that was going on in all the other living rooms in America where people stumbled across the U.S. Open. Like, that's what he had. That sounds like America, except America might not have been so nice about it. He did mess up and call it Chinese, though, because I think that's just a broad term that Cameron probably uses under those circumstances. But anyway, had a lot of interesting things go down at the Open. But none more than, is it Daniil Medvedev?
Yeah.
I had never heard of this dude before in my life. He is seeded number 5 at the U.S. Open. Number 5. He's apparently had a very good summer. And on Friday, the dude, like, snatched a towel from the ball person in a way that was kind of snippy. You know what I mean? And so people weren't really here for that. I think he got a penalty from the umpire, or at least chastised by the umpire for it. And so then he tried to do one of my least favorite things in the world, which is, like, give him the bird on the sneak. And he got fined for it later, but he didn't get a code violation in the match because the umpire had to see it, but the crowd saw it. And so the crowd was like, yo, this dude is such a jerk. He's out here snatching towels from people. He's out here giving people the bird. Like, that's what he is. Okay. And so by the end of the match, apparently they were just lustily, that's the term I've seen used a couple times, lustily booing him. And so he gets on the microphone to do his post-match interview. And he does this.
Daniil, quite an evening, quite an atmosphere in here. You're through to the next round. Talk to us about your emotions and how you're feeling.
Well, first of all, what I can say that thank you all, guys, because your energy tonight give me the win. Because if you were not here, guys, I would probably lose the match because I was so tired. I was cramping yesterday. It was so tough for me to play. So I want all of you to know, when you sleep tonight, I won because of you.
And he's just basking in the booze right now.
You're fed off this atmosphere. You're through to the fourth round, putting together a good year after a victory in Cincinnati, and actually your best Grand Slam tour to date since, obviously, the Australian Open. You're doing well out here.
Yeah, but again, the only thing I can say that the energy you're giving me right now, guys, I think it will be enough for my 5 next matches. I mean, the more you do this, the more I will win for you guys. Thank you.
Gabe, when you sleep tonight, know that I won because of you.
Absolutely next level.
And not even in his native language. Yo! He's the best at it since Ravishing Rick Rude. It was amazing. He just stood there. He's like waving his arms at it. He bathed and he took it all in. He turned me because he behaved indefensibly in that match. And I'm not here for tolerating grown-ups acting like children. And then he just did such a masterful trolling job that I'm like, oh, okay. I might be with this, right? And then last night, he didn't really get into it with the crowd, but they still didn't like him. And when he won, he did some bizarre little strut of sorts after he won. And then the booze came down. Another interview after the match.
What I need to say again is that today I was losing 6-3-2-0. I was painful in my adductor before the match. I thought I'm not going to play. I was painful in my shoulder. I took as much painkillers as I could. And you guys, being against me, you gave me so much energy to win. Thank you.
I love this. I absolutely love his get down. Love it, love it, love it, love it, love it. And so as I saw it and all this was going, I was about to be like, yo, I got my new favorite tennis player. Like, this is different than that dude, Kyrgios. Like, I think Kyrgios is unstable and self-destructive, right? I think this cat was just like, oh, y'all are going to boo me? Fine. I'm going to love it. By the way, Gabe, have you ever heard anybody get booed like that at a tennis tournament?
I have not. I have not. Even like when Kyrgios will slam his racket or other tennis players slam their racket, you rarely get a resounding boo like that.
Oh, that's right. Oh boy, Medvedev, he had a racket slam in that match where the booing first started.
Which he got fined for, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, he had a racket slam, which I'm like, come on, man, grow up. You know, so he's like, oh my God, but I've never heard a tennis crowd boo anybody like that. I can't think of anybody. I mean, he says that it's difficult for him to cope with the booing, so I think that this is like his defense mechanism or whatever it is, but I still can't recall ever seeing anybody just do this in this way. Like, I want him to win so bad, or I was saying that I wanted him to win, because good gracious, this is going to be awful for him if he loses. I mean, awful. awful if he loses. It is going to rain down upon him. So, yeah, I saw him and I was like, yeah, man, might have me a new favorite tennis player. You know what I'm saying? I might have a new cat for me to rock with. Like, I think most of y'all could have seen that dude and been like, yeah, this is your kind of guy. You know, I also saw one time that he was talking to one dude. I can't remember talking to the umpire or the other player. I saw a clip of it, and he was like, yo, man, I'm just saying, if you want to fight, let's, you know, they say you're talking like you want to fight. If you want to fight, let's fight. Yo, I'm here for all of this, especially in tennis. I am here for all of this. But I was like, yeah, you know, before I get out here making any public declarations about this being my dude and how I rock with him, let me do a little research on this cat. You know, he's got to check on these things. So I went to the wiki. This is under the heading early pro career. Medvedev was disqualified from the second round of the Savannah Challenger event for comments he made after the umpire ruled in favor of his opponent. Medvedev thought he had won a break point against his opponent, Donald Young's serve, but chair umpire Sandy French ruled that his returning shot had gone out. Now, Gabe, I'm going to take a pause and ask, are you familiar with Donald Young?
I am not.
I want you to Google him right fast. Tell me once you've seen his picture, and then I will continue to read. You see, this is where I started getting nervous.
Yes,
I started getting nervous. Medvedev said Young and French, who were both African-Americans, were friends. He was disqualified mid-match for, quote, questioning the impartiality of the umpire based on her race. Damn it, Gabe. Thought I had a new favorite tennis player.
The biggest dreams don't always work out, right?
Yeah, man. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to just admire his trolling as an independent act, but I just can't be out here, like, putting on the cape for him, defending him on stuff like this. Did I ever tell you that one of my favorite baseball players used to be John Rocker?
You didn't tell me that.
Yeah, I love John Rocker until I found out I didn't.
Yeah, you shouldn't always meet your heroes.
Yeah. That's just kind of what I'm saying here, right? Was that I've learned my lesson. I was like, nah, let me look this up before I get my heart into this. My heart is right squarely in the middle of my chest. But I do enjoy the trolling and look forward to more.
We know you can't be on top of all the news and information of the day. No need for the social media feeds. We got you. Now, if you haven't heard.
First story comes from local government, I would guess.
There we go.
That's a good way to describe it. Here it is.
Hi, this is Scott Simon of NPR, which is not the worldwide leader in sports, but it had a small story this week that kind of reminded me why so many Americans of all political types distrust what they call the Beltway mentality. So inside the Beltway in upscale Chevy Chase Village, Maryland, where so many people of power and influence live, they put up signs in a dog park that say, no excessive barking. Now, who did they think would read those signs? Even if dogs in Chevy Chase Village read the Wall Street Journal every day, they probably can't read signs that tell them no excessive barking. Turns out the locals wanted a dog park, and they began to complain when dogs began to act like dogs, sniffing, scratching, booing, barking. Some locals say they noticed a lot of people who drove to the dog park had license plates from D.C., the District of Columbia. You know, urban types, city folk with their loud, yapping dogs. So the village struck the dog park from the village website to make it harder to find. They hired a trained epidemiologist to track down how many outsiders park and bark at the dog park. She found it was just a few. The story of the signs in the Chevy Chase Village dog park demonstrated for me why so many Americans just distrust Beltway insiders. They think they're people who say something sounds great as long as you keep it out of their backyard. Beltway insiders fear outsiders, and they don't see the absurdity in commandments that may sound wise, like no excessive barking, but are as impossible as telling a dog not to bark.
I gotta say, though, I think that we may have a logical fallacy at play here, right? So, if 60% of people want a dog park, then that means 40% of people don't want a dog park, right? Once the dog park comes and there are complaints about what came with the dog park, my guess is the people complaining are the 40%, not the 60%. So those two ideas are actually pretty easy to reconcile. And what it sounds like is the people who don't have dogs and don't want to have dogs don't want it to sound like they have dogs when their windows are open in their neighborhood. I don't think that's terribly unreasonable. I just know you can't say nothing bad about dogs, which I am not. I'm not saying a bad word about dogs. Just want you to be clear. I am not saying anything bad about dogs. I'm just saying if I lived in a house that used to not be in front of the dog park and now it is in front of the dog park, I would have a little bit of a problem with it. I got no problem with dogs, but like I'm not like that super dog person. What I find interesting about this, though, is this is rich people versus rich people. Like, this is their battle among themselves. Do you realize how absurd and insane this is going to get by the end? Because let me tell you what this is. A bunch of people who like to sue.
100%. And also, I mean, what's interesting about it is that it's a, like, D.C. suburb that's complaining about the folks coming from
yes.
D.C. into their neighborhood and, like, parking in their parking spots that are public parking, by the way. Anyone can park there.
Yep, yeah,
parking in front of their houses. Hey, that's my spot. Get out of there.
Yo, they can park there, but come on. You know the deal. Like we now got more people just parking cars in the neighborhood. That'll come up at the meeting when that sort of thing happens, no matter what the, like, circumstance happened to be. What I thought was funny, too, was that Scott made the mention. He was like, oh, the urban folks, city folks. Nah, Scott, them people that's coming to use the Chevy Chase dog park are not the urban folks that those Chevy Chase people are normally afraid of. I feel pretty confident about that. Now I want to know, who are the people who are bringing their dogs to that park? Is that old D.C. or is that new D.C.? I got lots of curiosity. I got lots of curiosity about this one. But no, I understand if people are like, yo, the dogs are barking too loud. And you're like, yo, that's what dogs do. And somebody is saying in response, and that's why I told y'all not to build that damn park.
We're going to be following this story very closely, oh, yeah. I think. All right, this next story comes from Tech.
My name is Peter Holly, and I'm a reporter covering technology at the Washington Post. My latest story is about an emerging effort to change the way we interact with people after they die. My story begins with a man named Andrew Kaplan. He's lived a very long and interesting life, first as a foreign correspondent, later as a military veteran, and finally as a writer of screenplays, who was very successful. Andrew is in his 70s, and he knows he won't be able to pass on his life stories for that much longer. Someday he's going to die. So he signed up with a brand new startup company called Hereafter, and their goal is to make him one of the world's first virtual people. That means that all of Andrew's stories and experiences and beliefs and his social media presence will all be uploaded to the cloud. With the company's proprietary software, Andrew will become AndyBot, a virtual person that you'll be able to interact with on voice computing platforms like Amazon's Alexa or Google Home. Imagine walking into your kitchen and saying, hey Google, I want to talk to my dead grandpa, and then being able to have a conversation with him right there on the spot. Hereafter is just one of a handful of companies that are seeking to take our individual lives and upload them to the cloud where they can be preserved for eternity. Eventually, the goal is to turn virtual people into holograms that we would interact with like real people. But the virtual people we interact with won't just be our dead relatives. They'll also be assistants or people who teach us languages or people that are friends with your kids. Imagine if your kid's imaginary friend was no longer exactly imaginary, but another virtual child that could teach them lessons or watch them when they're playing alone. This is the future that we're quickly arriving at, and Hereafter is one of the first examples. There's still tons of questions to be answered. How does interacting with a virtual dead person impact your grief? What if you're mentally ill and you can't tell that it's actually a virtual person? Or what if companies design virtual people to be addictive? Basically, the only thing we do know is that pretty soon, we're all going to be seeing dead people.
Yo, that's terrible. Gabe, does that sound good to you?
Have you ever seen the show Futurama?
Yes.
So there is a, like, museum spot in Futurama where they've got all these former presidents, TV stars, and stuff that have passed away, and their heads are, like, in jars, and you can go talk to them, basically. It's like this, but done in a different way, and it just made me immediately think of that.
Yeah, let me just run a thought by you here, right? So my mama had an aunt, right? Aunt Retha was not the nicest woman I have ever met. I will not impugn Aunt Retha's character, but I'm just telling you, she wasn't the nicest woman that I've ever met. My mother will tell you that Aunt Retha wasn't the nicest woman that she had ever met. Okay? But I met Aunt Retha. Now, if I had never met Aunt Retha, my mama would be able to talk about Aunt Retha in a way that would allow me to create a picture of her in my mind. That would be one thing. And I have to tell you, I'm pretty sure whatever that picture was, if the virtual Aunt Retha was like the real Aunt Retha, meeting hologram Aunt Aretha was going to be pretty disappointing. And you know why? Because she wasn't the nicest woman that I've ever met. I would rather live into eternity via the memories and the tall tales that the people who love me will tell about me after the fact. I think you'll probably be a little disappointed if you come across me like in the real life. And I ain't got so much faith in these programmers and everything else to really know how I am, man. Y'all gonna have like a fake version of me out here in these streets. And that's absurd. No, I don't want to talk to any of these dead people. I understand the fear of missing out. Sometimes you miss out. You missed out, right? You missed out. That's just what it is. I had a chance to go see James Brown in concert in 2002. I didn't do it. I missed out. Never got to see James Brown live. That's just what it is. I never got to experience listening to Sam Cooke. I missed out. It happens. It's okay to say, damn, I wish I could have seen Jackie Wilson in concert, but I did not, right? It happens. It's not such a thing. No, this is bad. This is terrible. This is, ooh. And by the way, I guess we're doing it with like, I'm going to say this right now. I ain't got no problem saying this. It's a lot of people out here that when they die need to be dead. We need to act like they was never here in the first place. Not even they loved ones need to be like, well, I just want to talk to them again. No. Some of these people out here need to be dead forever. It's the best thing that could happen to us in many cases is that some of these people ain't around no more. We don't need to keep everything going. We don't. Look, man, I just had to throw out like 4 bags of T-shirts from the house because nothing lasts forever, and I'm better off without them. Some of these people are T-shirts.
Shouldn't always meet your heroes, right?
Forget about heroes. Shouldn't always meet, like, most of the people outside. Not most. That would be too far. I like humans in general. But some of y'all, whoo, glad I never met you.
So this last reporter wasn't able to join us, but I figured I could give you a little quick line on it and you can offer commentary. There was also a late entry that I thought I just could not pass up. So I'll ask you that after this. But as part of its new long-term partnership with the NFL and his long-term partnership with the NFL, Jay-Z's entertainment company Roc Nation has launched an apparel line and a music project that will support programs under the league's social justice initiative called Inspire Change. Your thoughts, Bo?
Let me ask you this. The people who care enough about social justice to buy a T-shirt supporting the cause, how many of them are going to buy that T-shirt from the NFL?
Not many, probably.
Like, and I'm being dead serious. Like, this is no hyperbole or exaggeration. This specific T-shirt that we're talking about, this Inspire Change, how many of those do you think that you are going to see on the streets of whatever? Like, it logically, y'all aren't the people to sell this. This is why it's part of the problem. Like, this is not a cause that you're not going to be able to, like, mainstream or put, like find a median way of expressing the cause, like a T-shirt with the NFL logo. Like, the NFL tries to sell itself as we're trying to sell this to everybody. That's not going to work here. That's not how that goes. And so, like, if you want to sell these T-shirts, that's fine. I don't even have a problem with the idea of them selling the T-shirts. It's just tone deaf of them to not understand that the people who care about these matters are not people who would ever buy that T-shirt. I'm telling you, man, they didn't really think this out in the first place. This is first and foremost a concert deal, and now they got to figure all this other stuff out along the way. That's 100% what this looks like.
So emergency, if you haven't heard, late ad happened in your hometown of Houston.
Oh.
So I figured I had to bring it in here. So according to Houston police, a group of people walked into a Popeyes and ordered chicken sandwiches. Employees informed the group of people that they were out, and a man in the group got upset, pulled out a gun, and demanded a sandwich, police said. Police also said that the employees ran to the back of the restaurant after the gun was pulled out. The group jumped into a blue SUV and left the scene. People are holding up Popeyes now, Bo.
Yeah, it's not a great. And look, they ain't got no sandwiches, man. They put out the announcement. They ain't really got no sandwiches. They gonna have to come back and, yo, have you seen the stories about like the workplace conditions for the people with the sandwich, making the sandwiches?
I've also seen the crude gifs and memes of Popeye's workers sweating and working a little too hard.
Yeah, no, but apparently, like, for real, it was like making shoes for Nike. Like, it was bad news back there from some of these reports about, like, what the circumstances were behind trying to satisfy the demand for these Popeye's sandwiches. I just want to say this, man, as a Houstonian, I don't know if that dude was really prepared to shoot somebody behind a Popeye's chicken sandwich. But his plan was a great way to get shot behind a Popeye's chicken sandwich. Because if there's one thing that Houston has taught me, never assume that you're the only person in here with a gun. Ever.
Hey, this is Bomani. You have reached the right time voicemail. Say whatever you want. Get creative with it. But this is your place to talk back to the show. So talk back. Peace.
Hi, Bo. Are you familiar with Taco Tuesday by chance?
I've heard of it once or twice.
The notion of Taco Tuesday. Are you familiar with LeBron's Taco Tuesday?
Yeah, I'm not sure how I feel about it. Yeah, that's bad.
Taco Tuesday!
Yeah, I didn't realize at first that he was trying to sound like a Mexican. And now that I do it, I'm like, yo, you got to stop doing this, bro.
That was cringeworthy. Yes. Every time that surfaced. But this past week, LeBron's company filed to trademark the phrase Taco Tuesday, which I thought was amazing. Because growing up in California, Taco Tuesday is a very popular thing. It's been going on forever.
Yes.
So I thought it would be funny to solicit voicemails from the listeners for stuff that they heard someone say that they invented, which couldn't possibly happen. Our first comes from DJ in Trinidad.
Hey, Bo, it is DJ from Trinidad and Tobago. My father has claimed that he invented the screensaver because he had this idea when he was working in an AV tech in Boeing in 1970-something. And, oh, yeah, you know, having that moving fireplace on your screen, I said that idea at a workplace, at a lunch thing, and, oh, yeah, it'll be best for all the screens. And he swears to God, he created screensavers. Bless his heart. He's a good man.
I told you my homeboy's daddy swears up and down that he who named Barry White the Walrus of Love.
Oh, boy.
He is adamant about this, right? And at one time I heard him talk about it, and he asked his wife. People are like, yo, tell them. She's like, oh, yeah. He came up with that. Yeah. I'm like, wow, you've been doing this for a long time. But he is convinced that he did that.
Oh, man, there are so many good ones. All right, this next one comes from Trav in Charlotte.
Good morning. What's up? It's Trav calling from Charlotte. Craziest story that is true that I invented something that's a trademark of it. I don't know if you remember the DJ Kool song, Let Me Clear My Throat, but me and my cousin swear to this day we came up with the beat for that song. How DJ Kool got it, I don't know. We must have been in the street. But if you and your listeners don't know how it goes a little something like this. Me and my cousin guy came up with that 100%, not a lot.
Yo, I have heard so many dudes who make beats. They all came up with all these songs already. That was my riff. I don't know how they got it from me. My roommate in college swore to some band he was best around when he came up with that bloom, bloom, bloom on The Sweetest Thing, the Fugees. He swears that they had that first.
Oh, my God.
Oh, yeah. In fact, we should have just opened it up just for that for people to talk about. No, I did that beat first.
I mean, it certainly happens often enough, right? Where someone will steal a beat from someone or someone will steal a track from somebody. Like, you know, Katy Perry got her hand caught in the cookie jar not too long ago. She got sued, copyright infringement. Happens often enough. But I just couldn't resist this one where the guy actually, like, sang it on the track.
So yes.
Couldn't get enough of it. All right, this last one comes from Russell in Florida.
Bomani, my name is Russell from Florida. I had a friend in 1996, I was 16 years old, sophomore in high school. He tried to tell me that his dad invented the ball cap buddy. I don't know if you ever remember seeing it in Lids, but it was like this little plastic looking thing, you know, that had the little arches over the top, and you put your baseball cap over the top after you washed it so it maintained its form. Okay, didn't believe him. He shows me this thing that looked like a big John Deere hat, and it had a big green plastic build to it and some big yellow form or whatever. I was like, that don't look like the ball cap, buddy. He was like, yeah, my dad invented this first. And I was like, whatever. But then later he tried to tell me that his uncle invented the fake palm tree. What? You don't invent fake palm trees. You just replicate one with rubber or plastic. It's not an invention.
I didn't realize so many people had these stories.
Oh, man. There are so many of them.
I was surprised that the feedback has been so strong. My brother contends that he came up with the euphemism for defecating, which is drop a deuce. And I, look, I have this happen to me all the time because I put stuff on Twitter and I can never tell when I got something cracking or maybe somebody else had already. Like, for example, I thought I was the first person to call Trey Young Trey DeBarge. And then I looked on Twitter after I had and found some other people had also called him Trey DeBarge. I didn't copy them. I didn't think about them. I had to go look at it. But you always think you invented something. I do be inventing some things, though.
Oh, really now?
I mean, just like things that people say. I'm an influencer.
The Bo-isms.
Yeah. I mean, come on now. Like, you think about some of those. Like, one, I think using cape as a verb, I was early on that one. Like, the idea of putting on your cape, okay, that was the thing. But you got to think, that's a lot of steps when you get to talking about cape, like caping, right? It goes from being a captain to having a cape, putting on your cape, and then caping as a verb. I believe I did that. Like, my man Rod always makes the point about the cats on the Hot Fire Starter podcast that, like, ether as a verb, they the ones that came up with that. You don't know that though, right? Like, these things just get around, but they really the ones where this started was like, that was them. That's where I was like, okay, I wasn't up on game. That's what that is. I be doing that from time to time and I don't even charge y'all. I deserve some credit for that. Wow. That was awkward.
Do you think that LeBron is too big for criticism when it comes to cultural appropriation like that?
No, I don't think he's too big for it. I don't think white people are comfortable with having that discussion, and I don't think that there are enough visible Latin people in our industry to really bring attention to it, because my man Cortez on the show was talking about it, and I honestly told him, like, this was me speaking from my privilege. I was like, yo, I didn't realize that he was trying to do an impression of a Mexican. Like, it's a bad one, right? Like, I didn't think that. And then after he said that and I heard that, I was like, no, you need to stop, homie.
The tacos that he's been having are also a poor impression.
Be careful, Savannah might have made him. Yeah. We should go home now. Ladies and gentlemen, thanks so much for joining us here on The Right Time. We do this thing a couple times a week. My man Gabe Bassain handles everything behind the scenes. Thank you, sir. Also, thanks to our sponsor, Lightstream. Thanks to our If You Haven't Heard contributors. Thanks to Scott Simon of NPR. Check out his story on what's really problematic about that dog park in Chevy Chase, Maryland. Thanks to MV Peter Holly of The Washington Post. Check out the Innovations blog and check out his story on the rise of virtual beings. It's really scary. WashingtonPost.com. Also, remember, subscribe to The Right Time wherever you get your podcasts. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to think you are a hater. And we'll talk to you guys in a couple of days. Take it easy.
Thanks for checking out The Right Time with Bomani Jones Podcast.
You can listen or subscribe on the ESPN app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The Right Time
with Bomani Jones.
The Right Time with Bomani Jones is presented by Goodyear. Discover the possibilities. Goodyear, more driven.